You're listening to Dystopia Radio, presenting radio plays of the future with warnings. Hello, this is Clyde J. Gale with a brief reminder. Mystery Play Internet Radio is listener-supported, so I encourage your monetary support with a donation today. Please visit www.mpir-otr.com and click on the donations page. A one-time donation of any amount will be greatly appreciated. Again, that's www.mpir-otr.com. And thank you for listening to Mystery Play Internet Radio.
Writing this manuscript to space, to help, perhaps, in averting the appalling scourge which is menacing the human race. Lord, have pity on us. As for me, Ulysse Méroux, I have set off again with my family in the spaceship. We can keep going for several years. One day, perhaps, we shall come across a friendly planet. It was in the year 2500 that I embarked with two companions in the cosmic ship with the intention of reaching the region of space where the supergigantic star Betelgeuse reigns supreme. Why was such a distant star chosen as the target for the first interstellar flight? It was the learned Professor Antel who made this decision. "My dear Ulysse," he said, "it is not much harder. And it is scarcely any longer for us to reach Betelgeuse than a much closer star. Thanks to its rockets, which I had the honor of designing, this craft can move at the speed of light. A few seconds for you and me will coincide with the passage of several years on Earth. We started from the moon. As Professor Rontel had foreseen, the voyage lasted about 2 years of our time, during which 3.5 centuries must have elapsed on Earth. If we came back one day, we should find our planet older by 700 or 800 years. But we did not care. The professor often admitted he was tired of our fellow men, and this probably explains why he had collected in the craft countless vegetable species and some animals, while limiting the number of passengers to 3, himself, his disciple Arthur Levin, and myself, a little-known journalist. The professor had also brought a little chimpanzee, whom we had christened Hector. On arriving in the Betelgeuse system, it was not long before we discovered the existence of 4 planets. One of these was about the same size as Earth, and possessed an atmosphere containing oxygen and nitrogen. We decided to make it our first objective. The craft was not equipped for landing, but we had 3 much smaller launches. We embarked in one of these, taking Hector the chimpanzee with us, who, like us, wore a diving suit. As for our ship, we simply let it revolve round the planet. Our flight swept us first over cultivated fields, then a thick russet-coloured forest, which called to mind our equatorial jungle. We caught sight of a fairly big clearing occupying the top of a plateau. We hovered motionless for a moment or two above the clearing, then came down gently, on green grass. We clambered out of the launch, and Professor Rontel analysed the atmosphere. The result was encouraging. The air had the same composition as the Earth's. It was undoubtedly breathable. To make doubly sure, we tried it out first on our chimpanzee. Rid of his suit, he appeared perfectly happy, and scampered off to the nearby forest, sprang into a tree, and continued his capering in the branches. Before taking a further step, we felt it was urgent to give the planet a name. We christened it Soror, because of its resemblance to Earth. Deciding to make an initial reconnaissance, we entered the forest which surrounded the plateau, following a sort of natural path. Arthur Levin and I were armed with carbines. We were marching in single file when young Levin, who was leading, stopped and motioned us to listen. A murmur like running water could be heard at a distance. We made our way in that direction and the sound became clearer. It was a waterfall. A stream of water twisted above our heads, spread out into a sheet on a ledge of level ground, and fell at our feet from a height of several yards into a lake. The sight of this water was so tempting that the same urge seized Levin and me. We took off our clothes and got ready to dive into the lake. But Professor Rontel went up to the edge of it, bent down, then cautiously touched it with his finger. Finally he scooped a little up in the palm of his hand, inhaled it, and wetted the end of his tongue. "It can't be anything but water," he muttered. Without further ado, the learned scientist likewise shed his clothes and plunged his skinny body into the pool. Arthur Levin alone seemed harassed and lost in thought. I was about to make a taunting remark on his melancholy expression when I saw a woman just above us, perched on the rocky ledge from which the cascade fell. She boldly asserted her femininity, completely naked, and without any ornament other than her hair, which hung down to her shoulders. I was so dazzled that I could not discern any particular feature. Her body hypnotized me. It was only after several minutes that I perceived her skin was golden rather than bronzed, that she was tall and slender. Finally, I looked at her eyes, and I stiffened, for in her expression there was a sort of void, an absence of expression, reminding me of a wretched mad girl I'd once known. She opened her mouth. I was prepared for the most barbarous language, but not for the strange sounds that came out of her throat, specifically out of her throat, which seemed to express the joyful frenzy of an animal. We heard a noise in the forest, and tumbling from branch to branch, our friend Hector came into view, landed on his feet, and scampered towards us. I was amazed to see the fright and menace that came over the young girl's face when she caught sight of the monkey. She drew back, hugging the rocks so closely as to melt into them, every muscle tensed, her back arched, her hands contracted like claws. When Hector passed close by without noticing her, she sprang out. She seized him by the throat and held the poor wretch firmly between her thighs. The monkey hardly struggled. He stiffened after a few seconds and fell dead when she let go of him. This gorgeous creature, in a romantic flight of fancy I had christened her Nova, being able to compare her appearance only to that of a brilliant star, Nova had, with her own hands, strangled a harmless pet animal. In a few seconds, she had disappeared into the undergrowth, leaving us standing aghast in the jungle, once again completely silent. We searched round the neighborhood of the stream, but did not find the slightest trace of the stranger, so we made our way back to the launch. We noticed them, little by little, while we forced ourselves to maintain a feigned indifference. They crept furtively out of the forest, all sturdy, handsome specimens of humanity, men and women with golden skins, looking restless now, evidently prey to a great excitement, and uttering an occasional sharp cry. They attacked as we came within sight of the clearing. In a moment we were overwhelmed. A mass of probing hands stripped us of our weapons and threw them aside, while others struggled to peel off our clothes and tear them to shreds. Once I had understood what had provoked their fury, I passively gave in, and if I received a few scratches, I was not seriously injured. Antel and Levan did the same, and we presently found ourselves stark naked in the midst of a group of men and women who, visibly reassured to see us in this state, started dancing round us, encircling us too tightly for escape. We witnessed, powerless, the sacking of our launch. The door had soon yielded to their thrusts. They rushed inside and destroyed everything that could be destroyed. We were jostled and pulled this way and that, when a terrifying hullabaloo made us start up in alarm. It was a strange cacophony, a mixture of rattling sounds like a roll of drums and also shouts. It was these shouts which made the most impression on us, for although they were in no language familiar to us, they were incontestably human. The elders of the tribe uttered a series of yelps, which were no doubt signals or orders, then rushed off in the opposite direction from the noise. The rest of them followed, and we saw them galloping all around us like a driven herd of deer. Nova, too, was about to take to her heels, but she paused all of a sudden and turned round towards us, above all towards me, I felt. She uttered a plaintive whimper which I took to be an invitation to follow her, then took one leap and disappeared. I did not pause to think. I did not even wait to consult my companions. I plunged into the undergrowth and likewise took to my heels in the young girl's footsteps. I ran as fast as I could without being able to catch up with her, and then noticed that Levin alone had followed me, Professor Antel's age precluding such a rapid flight. I was about to suggest going back when some other noises made us start up in alarm. They were gunshots echoing through the jungle. One, two, three, then several more at irregular intervals, strangely reminiscent of a double-barreled gun. They were firing in front of us on the path taken by the fugitives. Still followed by Levin, I clambered up a hillock and came to a halt at the summit, panting for breath. There was nothing in front of me but a few trees and a curtain of scrub. I advanced cautiously, my head on a level with the ground. There I lay for a moment or two as though floored by a blow, bludgeoned by a vision out of all proportion to my poor human mind. Stupefaction stifled all other sentiment when I saw the creature lying in wait for the game. It was a monkey, a large gorilla. He was dressed as you and I would be if we were taking part in one of those drives. His dark brown jacket seemed to be made by the best Paris tailor. His breeches, flaring out slightly above his calves, terminated in a pair of leggings. There the resemblance ended. Instead of boots, he wore big black gloves. All of a sudden, he stiffened. He had noticed, as I had, a faint sound in the bushes a little to my right. He turned round and at the same time raised his weapon. From my perch I could see the furrow left in the undergrowth by one of the fugitives, who was racing like a mountain goat across the open ground. The shot rang out while he was still halfway across the field of fire. He gave a leap into the air, collapsed in a heap, and after a few convulsions lay motionless. I had followed the change in the gorilla's expression from the moment he was alerted by the noise, and had registered a number of surprising factors. First of all, the cruelty of the hunter stalking his prey, and the feverish pleasure he derives from this pastime. But above all, the human character of his expression. In this animal's eyes, there was a spark of understanding which I had sought in vain among the men of Soror. The shot made me redirect my gaze towards the victim, and I was the horrified witness of his final twitches. I then noticed with terror that the alley intersecting the forest was littered with human bodies. The beaters were on our heels. I saw one of them emerge from the foliage. It was an enormous gorilla laying about him at random with a club and screeching fit to burst his lungs. Levin started chattering with fear, while I waited for an opportune moment. My wretched companion unconsciously saved my life by his imprudence. He got up, started running off at random, and came out into the alley in full view of the hunter's field of fire. The shot seemed to snap him in two, and he collapsed, adding his body to all those that already lay there. I wasted no time in mourning him. What could I do for him? But waited for the moment when the gorilla would hand his gun to his servant. As soon as he did so, I likewise sprang out and raced across the alley. Hardly had I gone 100 yards when I stumbled headfirst into a wide mesh net stretched above the ground. It ran across a large section of the forest, and a crowd of fugitives who had escaped being shot had let themselves be caught as I had. To my right and left, frenzied jerks accompanied by furious whines bore witness to their efforts to break free. I was eventually so closely bound that I could not move at all, and was at the mercy of the monkeys who I heard approaching. Some big carts, rather low on the ground and completely caged in, were lined up on a track on the other side of the net. Into these we were bundled, 10 or so to a vehicle, a lengthy operation, for the prisoners struggled desperately. 2 gorillas, their hands encased in leather gloves to protect them from bites, took hold of them one by one, freed them from the trap, and flung them into the cages, the doors of which were shut fast. When it came to my turn, I tried to draw attention to myself by talking. But no sooner had I opened my mouth than one of the monkeys brutally stuffed his enormous glove in my face. I was thrown like a bundle into a cage together with 12 men and women who were too agitated to pay any attention to me. We drove all through the night. I was utterly exhausted and succeeded in sleeping till daybreak, interrupted, however, by feverish nightmares in which Nova's body appeared in the guise of a monstrous serpent which wound round my own. I opened my eyes to the light. We were driving down a fairly broad street. I anxiously examined the passers-by. They were monkeys. I saw a tradesman, a sort of grocer, who had just raised the shutters of his shop, turn round in curiosity to watch us go by. He was a monkey. I tried to discern the passengers and drivers of the motor cars flashing past us. They were dressed in the same way as people at home, and they were monkeys. My hope of discovering a civilized human race became a chimera, and I spent the last stage of the drive in gloomy despair. We came to a halt in a courtyard. It was surrounded by buildings several stories high with identical rows of windows. The general effect was that of a hospital, and this impression was confirmed by the arrival of some new figures who came forward to meet our guards. They were all dressed in white smocks and little caps. They were monkeys. They helped our guards unload the carts. We were taken out of the cages, stuffed into sacks, and carried inside the building. Eventually, I was dumped on the ground, then thrown into a cage with a floor covered with straw in which I was alone. The room in which I found myself contained a large number of cages like mine, lined up in two rows. Most of them were already occupied, some of them by my companions of the roundup, others by men and women who must have been captured some time ago. They looked at the newcomers listlessly. Two gorillas came back carrying another sack. My friend Nova emerged from it, and I had the consolation of seeing her put into my cage. She protested against this, trying to scratch and bite. After a few minutes of this behavior, she caught sight of me, stood stock still, and extended her neck slightly like a surprised animal. I gave her a cautious half-smile and a little wave, which to my intense delight she clumsily tried to imitate. The two gorillas in white jackets returned, pushing a trolley laden with food. I decided to do all I could to establish contact with these monkeys. The one who brought me my food did not look unpleasant. Observing my tranquility, he even gave me a friendly tap on the shoulder. Looking him straight in the eye, I uttered rather stupidly the first phrase that came into my head. "How do you do? I am a man from Earth. I've had a long journey." The meaning was unimportant. I only needed to speak in order to reveal my true nature to him. I had certainly achieved my aim. Never before had such stupefaction been seen on a monkey's face. He stood gaping, and so did his companion. The two apes then looked at each other and began roaring with laughter. Tears were streaming down their faces, and one of them had to put down the bowl he was holding to take out his handkerchief. My disappointment was such that I immediately broke into a towering rage. I began shaking the bars, baring my teeth, and cursing them in every language I knew. When I had exhausted my repertoire of invectives, I went on giving incoherent yells, with the only result that they shrugged their shoulders. All the same, I had succeeded in attracting their attention. As they went off, they turned around several times to look at me. The following day, I saw a new figure enter the room, accompanied by the two warders. It was a female chimpanzee, and I realized she held an important post in the establishment from the way the gorillas kept in the background. I watched her carefully as she approached. What struck me most about her was her expression, which was remarkably alert and intelligent. She seemed to be quite young, in spite of the simian wrinkles that framed her white muzzle. "Good day to you, madame," I said with a bow. I had spoken in my gentlest voice. A look of intense surprise came over the she-monkey's face, but she maintained her composure and actually silenced with a gesture of authority the gorillas, who had started sniggering again. "Madame, or mademoiselle," I went on feeling encouraged, "I am sorry to present myself to you in these conditions and in this state of undress. Believe me, I'm not in the habit." I was once again spouting whatever nonsense came into my head. When I finished speaking, punctuating my speech with the gentlest of smiles, her surprise changed to stupefaction. Her eyes blinked several times, and the wrinkles on her forehead grew more pronounced. She, in her turn, smiled at me, and I had the impression that she was beginning to suspect a part of the truth. When she spoke haughtily to one of the gorillas, I was mad enough to hope that my cage was about to be thrown open with a million apologies. The warder fumbled in his pocket and took out a small white object which he handed to his superior. The latter put it herself in my hand with a charming smile. It was a lump of sugar. A lump of sugar. I felt suddenly so discouraged by the humiliation of this reward that I almost flung it back in her face. Just in time, I remembered my good resolutions and forced myself to remain calm. I took the sugar, bowed, and munched it with as intelligent an air as possible. Such was my first encounter with Zira. She was head of the department of the institution to which I had been brought. She had a long conversation with the guerrilla warders, and I fancied she was giving them instructions about me. Then she continued on her rounds, inspecting the other occupants of the cages. The following day, two figures came down the passage, Zira, the female chimpanzee, and another monkey who was plainly in a high position. He was an orang-utang, the first I had seen on the planet Soror. He was less tall than the gorillas and slightly round-shouldered, his head adorned with long, coarse hair, his face frozen in an expression of pedantic meditation. He looked like a venerable and solemn old pontiff. He was also dressed quite differently from the others, in a long black frock coat with a red star in the buttonhole, and black and white striped trousers, both somewhat dusty. Their arrival gave me an opportunity of noting again the sense of hierarchy which seemed to exist among the monkeys. Zira showed every sign of respect for this superior of hers. The two gorillas went forward to meet him as soon as they caught sight of him, and bowed low. The orang-utan gave a little condescending wave of his hand. He made straight for my cage. I welcomed the great authority with my most affable smile and addressed him in ringing tones. "My dear orang-utan, how happy I am to find myself at last in the presence of a creature who exhales wisdom and intelligence. I am sure we are going to understand each other, you and I." The dear old thing had given a start at the sound of my voice. He scratched his ear for some time and peered suspiciously into my cage as though scenting some trickery. Zira then addressed him, notebook in hand, reading out the particulars she had jotted down about me. She did her best, but it was plain to see that the orang-utan refused to be convinced. He uttered two or three sentences in a pompous manner, shrugged his shoulders several times, and started pacing up and down, passing and repassing in front of my cage, and darting glances in my direction that were far from benevolent. The other monkeys waited for his decision in respectful silence. I felt annoyed at his attitude towards me, and started pacing to and fro in my cage, imitating his gait, my shoulders hunched, my hands behind my back, my brow wrinkled in an air of profound meditation. The gorillas choked with laughter, and Zira herself was unable to keep a straight face. I was congratulating myself on my demonstration until I realized it was dangerous. Noticing my mimicry, the orang-utan looked extremely vexed and in a dry voice uttered a few sharp words which immediately restored order. But I had had enough of his blindness and resolved to give him fresh proof of my capabilities. Stretching my arms out towards him, I spoke up to the best of my ability.
"Me, Zaius."
I had noticed that all the subalterns who addressed him began with these two words. Zaius, I subsequently learnt, was the pontiff's name. Me, an honorific title. The monkeys were flabbergasted. They no longer wanted to laugh, least of all Zira, who seemed extremely perturbed, above all when I pointed a finger at her and added, "Zira," a name which I had likewise remembered, and which could only be hers. As for Zaius, he was all in a fluster and started pacing up and down the corridor, shaking his head with an incredulous air. Zira looked at me with a singular intensity, and her white muzzle turned pink, which, as I later learned, is a sign of emotion in chimpanzees. But there was nothing I could do to convince the orang-utan. This diabolical monkey started shrugging his shoulders, shaking his head energetically when Zira spoke to him, and then gave some decisive orders. The two gorillas, Zoram and Zanam, opened my cage, took Nova away, and brought me back instead an elderly matron. Worse was to come, however. In anguish, I watched my friend Nova being bundled off and was horrified to see her put into the cage directly opposite, delivered to a man with hefty shoulders, a hairy-chested colossus who started dancing round her, embarking with a frenzied ardor and a curious love display, a sort of slow, hesitant dance consisting of steps forward, backwards, and sideways. He moved thus in an ever-decreasing circle, a circle whose center was occupied by Nova. As soon as I saw what this brute was up to, I forgot my good resolutions. I screamed and yelled in the manner of the men of Soror. I showed my fury as they did by hurling myself against the bars, biting them, foaming at the mouth, grinding my teeth, behaving in short in a thoroughly bestial manner. Seeing me behave like this, Zaius smiled. It was the first mark of benevolence he had bestowed on me. He had at last perceived in me human behavior and had found himself on familiar ground. His theory had prevailed. This put him in such a good mood that he even consented, at a remark from Zira, to cancel his orders and give me one last chance. The dreadful old matron was led away, and Nova was restored to me before the hefty brute had touched her. The group of monkeys then stood back, and all three of them started observing me closely from a distance. What more can I say? These emotions had broken down my resistance. I felt I should never be able to bear the sight of my nymph at the mercy of another man. I resigned myself like a coward to the victory of the orang-utan, who was now smiling with pleasure at his astuteness. Hesitantly, I attempted a step of the dance. Yes, I, the ultimate achievement of millenary evolution, in front of an old orang-utan, in front of a female chimpanzee smiling with self-satisfaction, in front of a couple of chuckling gorillas, I, Ulysse Meru, embarked like a peacock round the gorgeous Nova on the love display. I must now admit that I adapted with remarkable ease to life in my cage. During the day, the monkeys attended to my every need. At night, I shared my litter with one of the loveliest girls in the cosmos. I grew so accustomed to this situation that for more than a month I made no attempt to put an end to it. One day, however, I felt nauseated and blushed at my cowardly resignation. What would Professor Antel think if he found me in this state? I forthwith made up my mind to behave like a civilized man. While stroking Zira's arm as a gesture of thanks for a sugar lump, I snatched her notebook and pen, sat down on the straw and sketched the system of Betelgeuse, marking Soror down in its exact position. The effect it had on Zira was extraordinary. Her muzzle turned purple, and she gave a sharp exclamation. Then, in another corner of the sheet, I drew out our dear old solar system with its principal planets. I indicated the Earth and pointed my finger at my own chest. She was flabbergasted and about to draw closer when Zaius appeared at the end of the corridor. Terrified, she quickly crumpled the paper, put her notebook into her pocket, and raised her forefinger to her lips with an air of entreaty. I obeyed her and promptly resumed my intelligent animal attitude. From then on, thanks to Zira, my knowledge of the simian world made rapid progress. She contrived to see me alone every day, instructing me in the simian language, while learning French with amazing rapidity. In less than 2 months, we were capable of holding a conversation on a variety of subjects. "I don't think you realize the danger you are in here on Soror." We were strolling through the park. Zira had consented to this only after much hesitation. It had taken some time for me to convince her of my origin, but she had now begun to work out a plan to liberate me. Meanwhile, my heart was thumping at being in the open air again, albeit naked and on the end of a collar and lead. Zira apologized for this, explaining that even though there were a few tame men who could be taken out without causing a scene, it was more normal if I were on a leash.
"Now listen," said Zira. "Your launch has been discovered. Our researchers realize it was not manufactured here."
"What about our spaceship, which has been in orbit around Soror for the last 2 months?"
"I haven't heard anything. It must have escaped the notice of our astronomers."
"But you must tell them, Zira," I cried. "Why are you hiding me away? Why not reveal the truth to everyone?" Zira stopped short, glanced all around her, and put her hand on my arm.
Because Zaius has decreed once and for all that your talents are due to a highly developed animal instinct, and nothing will make him change his opinion.
So I'm condemned to spend the rest of my life in a cage?
Not if my plan succeeds. In a month from now, we're holding our annual biological conference. Now, for us, public opinion is a more powerful element than Zaius. The best thing would be for you to speak up for yourself and make your case. This would cause such a sensation that Zaius wouldn't be able to stop you.
And if the others put their foot down?
Many of the others are not so stupid as Zaius. And there are also a few chimpanzees whom the Academy has been obliged to admit on account of their sensational discoveries. One of these is Cornelius, my fiancé. He's the only one I've spoken to about you. He has promised to help, but he does want to see you beforehand. That's partly why I've brought you here today. I've arranged to meet him.
Cornelius was waiting for us near a bank of giant ferns. He was a fine-looking chimpanzee, older than Zira, but extremely young for a learned academician.
Dr. Cornelius of the Academy, said Zira. Ulysse Meru, an inhabitant of the solar system, or to be more precise, the Earth.
I am delighted to make your acquaintance, I said. Zira has told me about you. I congratulate you on having such a charming fiancé.
So it's true, muttered Cornelius, looking at Zira in utter bewilderment.
After a moment's hesitation, he shook my hand. And you really come from Earth, a planet of the sun?
Cornelius started firing questions at me. We were strolling along, the two of them a few paces ahead and arm in arm, myself following on the end of my chain. But my replies aroused his scientific curiosity to such a pitch that he would often stop short, let go of his fiancée, and we would embark on a discussion face to face. When he left us, he held out his hand without a moment's hesitation.
From then on, Zira took me for outings in the park fairly often. Sometimes we would meet Cornelius, and together we would prepare the speech I was to deliver at the Congress. One day Zira suggested going to the zoo adjoining the park. The first cage at which we stopped contained at least 50 men, women, and children, exhibited there to the great glee of the monkey audience. Suddenly, among the herd, I saw none other than the leader and mastermind of our expedition, Professor Antel. I shuddered at the condition to which he had been reduced. He was among the quiet ones who stretched their hands through the bars with a begging grimace. I should have liked to speak to him, but Zira dissuaded me energetically.
After the Congress, she told me, when you have been recognized and accepted as a rational being, we will see about him.
The long-awaited date finally arrived. I was taken to a gigantic amphitheater of which every row of seats both around and above me was swarming with monkeys. There were several thousand of them. The guards pushed me towards the center of a circle which resembled a circus arena where a platform had been erected. The tiers of monkeys rose as high as the ceiling. The seats nearest to me were occupied by the members of the Congress, all of them learned scientists, dressed in striped trousers and dark frock coats, all of them wearing decorations, almost all of a venerable age, and almost all orang-utans. I looked for Cornelius, but could not see him. The President Gorilla rang his bell and announced he was giving the illustrious Zaius leave to speak. The orang-utan then rose to his feet. He declared that I was capable of a few tricks. Then he picked up a box with 9 different fastening systems, such as bolt, pin, key, and hook. It was a test I had completed with ease for Zaius while in my cage. But this time, instead of manipulating the locks, I raised my hand. Then, tugging gently on the lead held by a guard, I approached the microphone and addressed the President.
Illustrious President, I said in my best simian language. It is with the greatest pleasure that I shall open this box. Before embarking on this task, however, I beg permission to make an announcement.
All the monkeys remained glued to their seats, dumbfounded, holding their breath. The President gaped at me.
As for Zaius, he seemed to be in a towering rage.
Mr. President!
He yelled.
I protest!
But he stopped short, submerged by the ridicule of a discussion with a man. I took advantage of this to go on with my speech.
Listen to me, O monkeys, for I can talk and not like a mechanical parrot. I can think and I can talk and I can understand what you say. Not only am I a rational creature, but I come from a distant planet, from Earth.
I went up to a blackboard and by means of a few diagrams described the solar system and indicated its position in the galaxy. I then embarked on the account of my own adventures. I concluded with the following words.
Since I have come to know you, I find you all extraordinarily congenial, and I admire you with all my heart. I have learned more things in a few months' captivity among you than in all my previous existence. Let us unite our efforts. Let us march forward hand in hand, man and monkey together, and no power, no secret of the cosmos will be able to resist us.
I stopped speaking, exhausted, in total silence. I turned automatically to the president's table, picked up the glass of water there, and drained it in a gulp. This simple gesture produced an amazing effect, and was the signal for an absolute tumult. I was deafened by it. Monkeys, who are exuberant by nature, clap with all four hands when they are pleased. Zaius had just risen from his seat in fury. As though in a dream, I saw the vacant chair and collapsed into it, to a fresh burst of applause, which I barely heard before fainting dead away. It was some time before I recovered consciousness. I was lying on a bed in a room. Zira and Cornelius were attending to me, while some guerrillas in uniform held back a crowd of journalists and curious onlookers.
Magnificent,
Zira whispered in my ear.
You've won. Ulysse, said Cornelius, together we are going to do great things.
He told me that the Grand Council of Soror had just held a special meeting and had decided on my immediate release.
There were some who opposed it, but public opinion demanded it, and they had to yield. This is where you'll be living. I hope it suits you.
I looked round in bewilderment. The room was provided with every comfort. It was the beginning of a new epoch. After hoping so long for this moment, I was suddenly overwhelmed by an odd feeling of nostalgia. My eyes met Zira's, and a rather ambiguous smile came over her face.
Here, of course, she said, you won't have Nova with you.
I blushed, shrugged my shoulders, and sat up.
Do you feel well enough to attend a little party? Zira asked.
I replied that nothing would give me greater pleasure, but I was no longer willing to appear stark naked. I then noticed that I was wearing some pajamas.
We'll fit you out completely tomorrow, and you'll have a decent suit for this evening. Here's the tailor.
A little chimpanzee came in and treated me with great courtesy. In less than 2 hours, he had succeeded in making me an acceptable suit. It felt quite strange to be wearing clothes again. And Zira looked at me as though she had never seen me before. At the party, it was getting late and I was already tipsy, when the thought of Professor Ontell crossed my mind. Zira asked me why I was looking so sad. I told her. Cornelius then informed me that he had made inquiries about the professor and there would be no opposition to his release. I vehemently declared that I could not wait a minute longer. After all, Cornelius agreed, one can't refuse you anything on a day like this. Let's go. I know the director of the zoo. Day was breaking when we reached the cage in which the luckless scientist lived like an animal in the midst of 50 men and women. He was stretched out on the ground like the others, huddled against the body of a girl.
Professor, I said.
Master, it is I. Ulysse Meru, we are saved!
I stopped in amazement. At the sound of my voice, he had reacted in the same way as the men of the planet Soror. He had suddenly stretched his neck and shrank away.
Professor Rantel, I beseeched him. It's I, Ulysse Meru, your traveling companion. I am free, and in a few hours from now, so will you be. These monkeys, you see, know who we are, and welcome us like brothers.
He shrank back still further. Then, while I stood there trembling, while my heart went numb with horror, Professor Rantel gave vent to a long-drawn howl. I woke early after a restless night. I turned over three or four times in my bed and rubbed my eyes before fully recovering consciousness, still unaccustomed to the civilized life I'd been leading for a month, feeling anxious every morning at not hearing the straw rustle and not feeling Nova's warmth against me. The monkeys had proved extremely generous. I had a bedroom, a bathroom, clothes, books, a television set. I read all the papers. I was free. I could go out, walk about the streets, attend any entertainment. My presence in a public place still provoked considerable interest, but the emotion of the first few days had started to die down. Cornelius was now the scientific head of the Institute. Zaius had been dismissed. He had been given another post, however, and a new decoration. Zira had become Cornelius's assistant. As for me, I took part in the scientists' research work no longer as a guinea pig, but as a collaborator. With Cornelius's permission, I have embarked on a study of the men. I should like to teach them to talk. This is my great ambition. I have not succeeded, I admit. It is only with the utmost difficulty that some of them manage to repeat a monosyllabic sound or two. It is not much, but I am persevering. What encourages me is the new insistence with which their eyes try to meet mine, eyes which for some time have seemed to be gradually changing in expression, and in which I fancy I can see a suggestion of the curiosity of a superior substance peering through the animal perplexity. I move slowly round the room, stopping in front of each of the captives. I speak to them gently, with patience. They seem to listen. I go on for several minutes, then give up speaking in whole sentences and pronounce a few simple words, repeating them over and over again, hoping for an echo. One of them clumsily articulates a syllable, but this is as far as he will go today. The subject soon gets tired, abandons the superhuman task, and lies down on the floor as though after some exhausting effort. I sigh and pass on to the next one. I finally come to the cage in which Nova is vegetating in solitary sadness. I often think of Nova. I cannot forget the hours I spent in her company. But I have never again entered her cage. Human self-respect forbids me. Is she not an animal? I now live in the highest scientific circles. How could I let myself indulge in such promiscuity? I blush at the thought of our former intimacy. Since I have changed camps, I have forbidden myself to show her more affection than I show to her fellows. I utter her name, then my own, pointing my finger alternately at her and myself. She imitates the gesture. But I see her expression change all of a sudden, and she bares her teeth as I hear a gentle chuckle behind me. It is Zira, accompanied by Cornelius, who laughs without unkindness at my efforts, and Zira's presence always incites Nova to anger. Cornelius is interested in my endeavors and often comes to see the results for himself. Today he looks rather excited. Would you like to go on a little trip with me, Ulysse?
A trip?
Quite a long one, almost to the Antipodes. Some archaeologists have discovered some extremely curious ruins out there. We set off a week later. Cornelius has not told me anything more, and I feel he is reluctant to do so, but what I already discern in his theories gives me a strange sense of exultation. It is a whole city that the archaeologists have laid bare, a city buried in the sands of a desert, of which nothing remains but ruins. Something existed before this present era. But what?
After a month of feverish investigation, we're disappointed. For it seems that this prehistoric city itself was not so different from those of the present day. We have discovered remnants of houses, traces of factories, vestiges showing that these forebears possessed motor cars and aeroplanes, just like the monkeys of the day. These show that the origins of mind can be traced far back into the past. This morning, Cornelius has gone ahead of me to the spot where the workmen have laid bare a house, with thick walls made of a sort of reinforced concrete which seems better preserved than the rest. I am still idling outside the tent, which I share with Cornelius. He is in the trench with the workmen. He often takes a hand in the digging for fear they might do something silly and an interesting object escape them. Here he is, emerging from the hole, holding in his hand a small object, which I cannot make out.
Ulysse! Ulysse!
Whatever is it?
A doll, Ulysse! A doll!
It is a doll, an ordinary China doll. By a miracle, it has been preserved, almost intact, with vestiges of hair and eyes, which still reveal a few chips of color. It takes me several seconds to realize. Then I've got it. It is a human doll, representing a little girl like one on Earth. This doll is clothed like a doll at home. The remnants of a frock, a blouse, a skirt, and knickers can still be clearly seen, dressed with the taste which a little girl on Earth might show in adorning her favorite doll. With the care that a little she-monkey on Soror would take to clothe her monkey doll. The care which she would never, never show to dress up an animal figure like the human figure. And this is not all. In putting it down, Cornelius happened to press the mechanism which has been preserved intact. It uttered one word. Papa. The doll talks. Papa. The little human doll repeats as Cornelius picks it up and turns it round and round in his nimble hands. Cornelius remains wrapped in thought for the rest of the day. I have the impression he is now frightened of pursuing his research and is regretting his semi-revelations. Now that his excitement has abated, he is sorry that I should have witnessed his discovery. On the very next day, I am given proof that he regrets having brought me here with him. After a night's reflection, he informs me, avoiding my eyes, that he has decided to send me back to the Institute, where I shall be able to continue with more important work than in these ruins. My seat on the aircraft is booked. I shall be leaving in 24 hours. I spent the month following my return in bed, suffering from an infection I had probably picked up on the site, and which assumed the form of violent bouts of fever, similar to malaria. I was not in pain, but my brain was on fire and could not stop turning over in my head the elements of the fearful truth that I had glimpsed. There was no more doubt in my mind that a human era had preceded the simian age on the planet Soror, and this conviction gave me a sort of intoxication. On second thoughts, however, I'm not sure if I ought to feel proud of this discovery or be profoundly humiliated by it. My self-respect notes with satisfaction that monkeys have invented nothing, that they are mere imitators. My humiliation derives from the fact that a human civilization could have been so easily assimilated by monkeys. How could this have happened? In my delirium, I could not keep my mind off the problem. True, we civilized folk have known for a long time that we are mortal, but such a complete disappearance makes the senses reel. A sudden disaster? A cataclysm? Or else the slow decline of the one and the progressive ascent of the other? I am inclined to the latter hypothesis, and I find it extremely indicative of this evolution in the monkeys' present-day conditions and preoccupations. This importance they attach to biological research, for instance. I am fully aware of its origin. In the old days, many monkeys must have served as experimental subjects for men, as in the case of our own laboratories. These were the ones who first hoisted the flag, who were the pioneers of the revolution. They would naturally have begun by imitating the gestures and attitudes observed in their masters, and these masters were researchers, learned biologists, doctors, nurses, and warders. It is now 2 months since I first visited my former companions in captivity, my fellow humans. Today I feel better. I have no more fever. Yesterday I told Zira. Zira has looked after me like a sister during my illness. I told her that I was planning to resume my work in the department. She did not seem very pleased, but she raised no objections. It is time for me to pay my visit. A strange emotion makes me pause on the threshold. I now see these creatures in a new light. It is with anguish that I wonder, before making up my mind to enter, if they will recognize me after my long absence. Well, they do recognize me. All their eyes are fixed on me, as they always used to be, and even with a sort of deference. Am I dreaming, or do I really discern a new look in them, a look reserved for me and different from the glances they bestow on their monkey warders? A gleam impossible to describe, but in which I fancy I see an awakened curiosity, an unusual emotion, shades of ancestral memories trying to emerge from bestiality, and perhaps an uncertain glimmer of hope. This hope I have myself unconsciously nourished for some time. Is it not the reason why I am overwhelmed by this feverish exultation? Am not I, Ulysse Meru, the man whom destiny has brought to this planet to be the instrument of human regeneration? Here, distinctly stated at last, is the hazy notion that has been haunting me for a month. The good Lord does not play dice, as a certain physicist once said. Nothing happens by mere chance in the cosmos. My voyage to the world of Betelgeuse was decreed by a superior consciousness. It is up to me to show myself worthy of the choice and to be the new savior of this human race in decline. As before, I go slowly round the cages. I force myself not to rush over to Nova's cage at once. Is the envoy of destiny entitled to favorites? I speak to each of my subjects. The moment has not yet come for them to talk. I do not mind. I have my entire lifetime to accomplish my mission. I now approach my former cage with studied negligence. I look out of the corner of my eye, but I do not see Nova's arm stretched out through the bars. I do not hear the cries of joy with which she always used to greet me. A strange misgiving assails me. I cannot restrain myself. I dash forward. The cage is empty. I summon one of the warders in an authoritative voice, which makes the captives shiver. Zanam is the one who appears. He does not like receiving orders from me, but Zira has decreed that he should hold himself at my disposal.
Where is Nova?
He replies he does not know, in a surly manner. She was taken away one day without any reason being given. I repeat my question, in vain. At that moment, luckily, Zira turns up to carry out her tour of inspection. She sees me in front of the empty cage and realizes why I'm so upset. She looks embarrassed and at once starts talking about something else.
Cornelius has just come back. He wants to see you.
At the moment, I don't give a damn about Cornelius or the chimpanzees or the gorillas or any other creature in heaven or hell. I point at the cell with my finger.
Where's Nova?
She's ill, says Zira. She's been transferred to a special wing.
She beckons to me and leads me aside out of earshot of the warder.
They made me promise to keep it secret, but I feel you ought to know.
She's ill?
Nothing serious. But it's important enough to put the authorities on their toes. Nova is expecting.
She's...
I mean she's pregnant,
Zira announces, observing me with a curious expression.
One day, Cornelius decided to take me to the encephalic section. He introduced me to the head of the department, a young chimpanzee called Helios, and apologized for not being able to show me round himself on account of some urgent work. Helios showed me into a room similar to those in the Institute. We walked past cages occupied by men and women of all ages. My stomach heaved from a succession of horrors. I saw men partially or totally paralyzed, others artificially deprived of sight. I saw a young mother whose maternal instinct, once highly developed, so Helios assured me, had completely disappeared after interference with the cervical cortex. She kept thrusting away a young child of her own whenever it attempted to approach her. This was too much for me. I thought of Nova, of her impending motherhood, and clenched my fists in rage. Luckily, Helios showed me into another room, which gave me time to recover my composure. "Here," he said with a mysterious air, "we indulge in more delicate research. It's no longer the scalpel that is brought to bear. It is a far more subtle medium. Electrical stimulation of certain points in the brain. Do you practice this sort of thing on Earth?"
"Yes, on monkeys," I retorted in fury. The chimpanzee kept his temper and smiled. Cornelius, who had just come in, gave me a friendly tap on the shoulder.
"But you must admit that thanks to them, our medicine and surgery have made enormous progress in the last quarter of a century."
This argument did not convince me any more than the memory I had of the same treatment applied to chimpanzees in a laboratory on Earth. Cornelius shrugged and dragged me off to a smaller room.
"Only two of us ever go into this room," he told me in a solemn tone, "Helios and myself. So you see the importance I attach to this work."
There were only two subjects, a man and a woman, lying strapped down on two parallel divans.
"All is well," said Helios. "They are quite calm. We can embark on a test straight away."
Helios anesthetized the two patients and started up various machines. He then carefully unrolled the bandage which covered the man's skull and, aiming at a certain spot, applied the electrodes. The man remained absolutely still. I was questioning Cornelius with my eyes when the miracle happened.
The man began to talk. His voice echoed round the room with an abruptness which made me start.
He must have been captive in the Institute for a long time and kept repeating snatches of sentences he had heard spoken by the nurses or the scientists.
Cornelius presently put a stop to this experiment. We'll get nothing more out of this chap, but the main point is he talks.
It's amazing, I stammered.
You haven't seen anything yet, said Helios. He talks like a parrot or a gramophone. But I've done much better with her.
He indicated the woman who was sleeping peacefully.
1,000 times better, said Cornelius, who betrayed the same excitement as his colleague. Helios has succeeded in awakening not only her own individual memory, but the memory of her species.
I was so amazed by this extravagant claim that for a moment I really believed that the learned Cornelius had gone mad. But Helios was already handling his electrodes and applying them to the woman's brain. The latter remained inert for some time, just like the man. Then she heaved a deep sigh and started talking.
For some time, said the anxious voice, these monkeys have been ceaselessly multiplying. We have been wrong to tame them and to grant those whom we use as servants a certain amount of liberty.
The woman paused, heaved several anguished sighs, then went on.
It's happened. One of them has succeeded in talking. I read about it in Woman's Journal. There's a photograph of him, too. He's a chimpanzee.
A chimpanzee? The first, just as I thought,
Cornelius exclaimed.
After a long silence, the woman's voice continued in anguish.
I was too frightened. I preferred to hand the place over to my gorilla. He had been with me for years and was a loyal servant. He started going out in the evenings to attend meetings. He refused to do any work. I was too miserable. I abdicated. I have taken refuge in a camp with other women who are in the same plight as myself. There are some men here as well. Most of them have no more courage than we have. We feel ashamed and barely speak to one another.
Another feminine voice succeeded hers.
I was a lady animal tamer. I used to do an act with 12 orang-utans, magnificent beasts. Today, I'm inside the cage instead of them, together with some other circus performers. To give them their due, the monkeys treat us well and give us plenty to eat. They change the straw on our bedding when it gets too dirty. They're not unkind. They punish only those of us who show reluctance and refuse to perform the tricks they teach us. I'm not unhappy. I have no more worries or responsibilities.
The woman fell silent, during which Cornelius gazed at me with embarrassing insistence. I could read his thoughts only too well. Had it not been high time for such a feeble race of men who gave in so easily to make way for a nobler breed? I blushed and looked away.
I have a child.
Nova has given birth to a boy. I know he is a splendid baby, but it is a month since I last saw him. The security measures have been tightened still more. Zira, who is suspect to the authorities, is under close surveillance.
Cornelius has many enemies. He dares not frankly proclaim his discovery. Even if he thought of doing so, his superiors would no doubt be against it. The Orang-Utan clan, led by Zayas, is intriguing against him. They talk about a conspiracy against the simian race, and point me out more or less openly as one of the factionists. Cornelius is looking for me. There is something serious he wants to discuss. I follow him into the office where Zira is waiting. Her eyes are red as though she has been weeping. They seem to have bad news for me, but neither of them dares to speak.
My son?
He's very well, Zira abruptly says.
Too well, Cornelius mutters with a frown. He smiles. He cries like a baby monkey. And he has begun to talk.
3 months old.
I am delighted. Zira is annoyed by my doting father manner.
But don't you realize this is a disaster? The others will never leave him at liberty. Your son is going to be placed in a sort of fortress under the surveillance of the orang-utans. Zayas has been intriguing for some time, and he is going to get the better of us.
I am dumbfounded.
It is not possible to leave my son in the hands of that dangerous imbecile. It is not only the child that is menaced, says Cornelius abruptly. I'm very much afraid that within the next 2 weeks the council might decide to eliminate you, or at least remove a part of your brain on the pretext of some experiment.
Zira puts her hand on my shoulder.
You must get away. You must go back to where you belong on Earth. Your son's safety and your own demand it.
Her voice breaks as though she's on the verge of tears. I am also deeply upset. No less at her sorrow than at the thought of leaving her forever. But how to escape from this planet? Cornelius has a plan.
Your spacecraft is still orbiting round our planet. An astronomer friend of mine has tracked it down and knows every detail of its trajectory. Now, listen. In exactly 10 days' time, we are going to launch an artificial satellite, manned by humans, of course, on whom we want to experiment the effects of certain rays. No, don't interrupt. The number of passengers will be limited to 3. 1 man, 1 woman, and a child. You 3 will take the place of the passengers. I've already got the necessary accomplices. The others won't even notice the trick that's been played on them.
I take the opportunity of thanking Cornelius with all my heart. Inwardly, I'm wondering why he's doing all this for me. He reads my thoughts. Zira is the one you ought to thank, he says. It's to her you owe your life. On my own, I don't know if I should have taken so many risks, and anyway... He pauses. Zira is waiting for me in the corridor outside. He makes sure she cannot hear and quickly whispers.
Anyway, for her as well as for me, it is better that you should vanish from this planet.
He closes the door after me as I leave the room. I am alone with Zira. I take her in my arms. I see a tear coursing down her muzzle while we stand locked in a tight embrace. We're about to kiss like lovers, when she gives an instinctive start and thrusts me away with violence. While I stand there, speechless, not knowing what attitude to adopt, she hides her head in her long, hairy paws and bursts into tears.
Oh, darling, it's impossible. It's a shame, but I can't. I can't. You are really too unattractive.
We have brought it off. I am once again traveling through space aboard the cosmic craft, rushing like a comet in the direction of the solar system at an ever-increasing speed. With me are Nova and Sirius, the fruit of our interplanetary passion. We have been traveling for more than a year and a half of our own time. Nova is bearing the voyage extremely well. She is becoming more and more rational. Her motherhood has transformed her. She spends hours doting on her son, who is proving to be a better teacher for her than I was. As for Sirius, he is the pearl of the cosmos. He walks despite the heavy gravity and babbles without stopping. The sun is growing bigger every moment. I try to distinguish the planets in the telescope. I can find my bearings easily. I can see Jupiter, Saturn, Mars, and the Earth. Yes, here is the Earth. Tears come to my eyes. I know after 700 years I shall find neither parents nor friends, but I can hardly wait to see proper men again. We have entered the atmosphere. Nova looks at me and smiles. My son stretches his arms out and opens his eyes in wonder. Below us is Paris. The Eiffel Tower is still there. After 700 years' absence, I manage to land at Orly, which has not changed very much, at the end of the airfield, fairly far from the airport buildings. A vehicle approaches. It is a truck. A fairly old-fashioned model, 4 wheels and a combustion engine. I should have thought such vehicles had been relegated long ago to museums. The truck stops 50 yards from us. I pick up my son in my arms and leave the launch. Nova follows us after a moment's hesitation. She looks scared. She will soon get over it. The driver gets out of the vehicle. He has his back turned to me. He is half concealed by the long grass growing in the space between us. He opens the door for the passenger to alight. He is an officer, a senior officer, as I now see from his badges of rank. He jumps down. He takes a few steps towards us, emerges from the grass, and at last appears in full view. Nova utters a scream, snatches my son from me, and rushes back with him to the launch, while I remain rooted to the spot, unable to move a muscle or utter a sound. He is a gorilla.
Thank you.